okay, well, where's the security in this process? Well, it's usually after the fact, right? It's when they're trying to deploy. It's in there like, hey, I can't get this to deploy. Well, that's a good thing, right? That means we got security in advance. And that would be great. But a lot of times it's very reactive. And here I'm not talking about the federal government or private sector, but both at this point. A lot of times things just get pushed into production. We find out about them because we write scripts to find out if these things are out of compliance.
I'm Steve Stonebreaker, and this is Ephemeral Security. We have with us today Matt Wright. Matt, how are you doing?
Hey, pretty good. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Thanks for coming. Matt's been a guest with us before. Maybe those that haven't heard other episodes with you on, can you give a brief introduction?
I'm a senior security engineer. I spent 14 years in the Navy. About 10 of it was security focused.
Awesome. And when did you first use a computer?
Oh, wow. I built my first computer when I was 10 years old, part by part, because we didn't have enough money to actually buy a whole computer. So every month we would get a different part of a computer. We didn't think to just save up and eventually buy one. Read the motherboard manual, figured out with my dad helping me, you know, what pieces might go where, and about 23 years ago.
Nice. And so then did you get on the internet, or what were you doing on the computer?
We wanted to play games. Pentium 3s were pretty new back then, and we ended up finding out about AMD, and we went with the Athlon series. Saved a few bucks.
So you joined the service. Can you tell me about some of the stuff you learned there with computers?
Yeah. So I started off more or less doing help desk work in numerous different environments, and I ended up doing that in some forward deployed locations and helping out the Army and the Air Force with some joint service work. During that time, I got some experience to doing cybersecurity work, and I started getting pulled more and more into that direction. But before I could get there, I ended up being a network engineer, a system engineer, system administrator, a virtual systems administrator, a virtual systems engineer, and then I got pulled into special projects that were kind of more development related, like a lot of shell scripting and just systems integration kind of stuff for cybersecurity projects. And then I started managing like defense infrastructure, you know, the DoD, they call it the Global Information Grid. And then eventually I landed into security for the GovCloud. And that was kind of the last thing I did before I got out.
For those of us that might not know, what is the GovCloud?
The GovCloud is a specially accredited and structured piece of Amazon Web Services. And it's particularly tailored to the needs of federal government. It has FedRAMP compliance, kind of a newer way of meeting old standards that's compliant with the way the cloud deploys things, because the old standards were written, like your NIST series and things like that, were all written when you had full control of the whole stack, right, end to end. But that's just not the case anymore. Everyone's trying to move to leased infrastructure, at least, if not, you know, managed applications and services. So FedRAMP was a way to modernize that. And GovCloud was largely developed hand in hand with several federal entities in order to make sure that the federal government could have cloud adoption.
Okay, so there's FedRAMP and Amazon create a special cloud for the government. Security problem solved, right?
Easy day. Yeah, no, I can still hook up to the regular internet, right? So you definitely have to watch people. A lot of the, and the longer I've kind of stayed in cloud security, the more I've seen it's a lot of, everyone knows what the best practices are, but not everyone does them, especially when you got someone screaming in your ear that, hey, I need this coming out tomorrow, right? The more pressure you put on people, and especially with all the force reductions and reduction in personnel, you get people who are overworked, management becomes more difficult, onus becomes on the developer themselves, right? It's because, okay, the head of product got fired, they're hitting the road, or this contract rolled out, and whatnot, but you end up with a real lean team. And as all that turnover happens, that's all absorbed by the dev themselves, right? And then it's kind of like, okay, well, where's the security in this process? Well, it's usually after the fact, right? It's when they're trying to deploy. It's in there like, hey, I can't get this to deploy. Well, that's a good thing, right? That means we got security in advance. And that would be great. But a lot of times it's very reactive, right? And here I'm not talking about the federal government or private sector, but both at this point. A lot of times things just get pushed into production. We find out about them because we write scripts to find out if these things are out of compliance, or we use utilities that we found, or we get an expensive CSPM tool, right? That just comes in and says, hey, I think this is wacky, you know, and you get to triage all those results. I do still kind of find that the best results tend to come from kind of homebrewed scripts, because you usually tend to know what you're looking for better than super tool that's very generic. Sorry, I kind of talking while I forgot what the original question was.
No, that's fine. I'm glad we've kind of moved over to CSPM. That's something near and dear to my heart. It is certainly something that I've never seen go right. Homebrewed scripts are the way to go. Sometimes it's funny. I've had to like sometimes figure out, okay, was this IP address assigned to this cloud account a year and a half ago, right? I ended up figuring it out a lot faster because I had like an old Nmap scan, but it can certainly be tricky. What's your take on the what's currently out there with CSPM? And sorry, for those of you that don't know, CSPM is Cloud Security Posture Management.
As it currently stands in the CSPM space, the best ones seem to do data aggregation, and they put all of your data in some sort of data lake, right? And they do normalization in different ways. So like a couple of those examples, one's called, I think, Jupyter One, and another's Wiz. But the idea there is, hey, let's dump everything into a data lake, take advantage of all those optimizations and things, a managed data lake, by the way. Both of these are like, they're like either Snowflake backed or Databricks or something. In one of them, the idea there, in either of them, the idea is if we get everything in a way that's normalized to the maximum extent possible, and then in a way that we can query it, we can start making really, really difficult relations, real complex associations and things, and get all of that context very rapid. The challenge there is you are usually constrained to doing some kind of graph logic, right? Using graph APIs instead of more traditional like SQL queries and things, which would be nice. Because really what I want is, hey, this entity, you know, insert operators here, this entity over here, right? What's the configurations? Is this vulnerable? Most of the time when I'm querying it, I'm like, hey, is this, you know, vulnerable to this particular CVE? And the other times when I'm doing it, it's, hey, was this able to communicate with this device that may or may not have been compromised, right? And I'm trying to walk that chain back and figure out everything that was connected. And when those things, when either of those events take place, it's very, very challenging to use like graph logic and construct these giant GQL queries and be like, hey, you know, we fire this off and figure it out. Wiz has gotten around that very well because they have something called the security graph, which is like a visual way to construct queries and fire them off. But I think there's a lot of room for improvement in that space, especially if you could, again, use something like a little more user-friendly like SQL.
Right. And just because they can talk to each other, sure, you might have a AWS security group and the rules might allow all traffic inbound. But if it's not hooked up to an external IP address, it's not going to be any traffic, right, directly from the internet. It could be hooked up to a load balancer maybe, right? But then it's like, what are the security groups and load balancer? And so even with some of those relations, maybe there is a network path, but there could be a software firewall, right, that you didn't know about. And so your graph's not going to pick that up. So I know, I found that flow data can be very helpful to actually know what's talked to my devices when. I've seen very few CSPM tools take advantage of flow data. What's your take on flow data and CSPMs together?
So this is completely my personal opinion, not based on any best practice or anything. But I generally say flow data, you should collect it on anything that is external facing. And any inbound traffic, right? That's really where you need it is, because a lot of it, like let's say you have ELB access logs and things, and your load balancers logging everything that's coming into it. You still want the net flow logs to figure out what they were coming back to on the other side, or else you're going to chase down every single one of those nodes and pull all the logs on every everything that LB was connected to. That's kind of a miserable endeavor, right? I will say, as far as validating findings, that's another one where actually Wiz has come through pretty strong. Like they'll take screenshots. They'll reach out from outside your network, come in, and then they'll show you, this is a valid finding. You know, I was able to actually return this plain text data and give it to you in a PNG file. They've definitely come a long way. Well, I will say some CSPMs have come a long way. They still have a longer way to go.
That almost sounds like partially attack service management, right? If they're calling from the outside, taking screenshots, is there an HTTP body response as well?
Kind of. So your attack surface management platforms are usually walking your public footprint that's enumeratable, and they're pulling all the artifacts out of all of those websites, right? The certificates, all the subdomains that they can find linked, and they try to assemble all of it and then attack them all individually. This is more just for things that it already knows exists based on your infrastructure that it's collecting. So it'd be like, hey, this is an API gateway I think is configured publicly. And then that allows unauthenticated access to, let's say, a database or something behind it. It'll try and validate that by constructing a REST request against that.
You have to wonder if like CSPM and ASM, it'd be kind of cool if there was like a solution that did all of that.
Right. Like I would very much like to see something that took like hosted SaaS platforms into account as well. Asterisk has been coming a long way as far as figuring out how to at least get a start on SaaS security, right? Especially when it comes to tokens and things. Because like, let's say you have a million different accounts from three different SaaS platforms. How do you aggregate all that and figure out which one of these might have had something bad go wrong with it, right? Like a token leak or let's say that there was a massive event with a certain platform, like a GCP or something like that. How do I know that those credentials are still safe or if they were affected? And they've gone a long way towards getting after those kind of questions. And I thought it was really impressive. And I don't really see anyone else in that space competing at the moment.
How do you know if the credentials are safe? So you were talking about like the Google Cloud JSON private key or whatever, and using that to access Google Cloud.
Let's look at something kind of a recent use case or a recent case study, the Circle CI. So Circle CI Credly, right? Everyone was up for days on that one all around the world. If you wanted to know what Circle CI creds that you had connected, if you were sending your logs off to a platform like Asterisk, now mind you, I don't know if Asterisk can ingest Circle CI, but this would be a use case for how I would see that platform working. I would know where all of those accounts are connected to, right? I would know, hey, that one's a GCP account that was over here. Hey, that one's all the million of things that you have tied into a development pipeline, right? AWS creds, GCP creds. Even though I had one credential exposure, because I'm able to query the Asterisk's system, I'm able to see where all those credentials are connected across all the other SaaS platforms. So I would know immediately where all my exposures were.
So this just ingesting audit logs from Circle CI into a platform that can extract the data and give it to you in a meaningful way?
Yeah, it extracts, ingests data from all these different SaaS platforms, GitHub, WordPress, several managed WordPress platforms, all the major cloud providers. But yeah, it's very much most of the detections that they have written, because they have pre-canned detections that they've written. You actually have quite a bit out of the box. But I think the main value in it right now, especially in the early development phase, is for security analysts, either post-incident or post-event, using it for analytics to figure out how bad was this? What's my real blast radius here, quick, fast, and in a hurry, without having to sit there and pull logs from several different locations, perform your own aggregation, and then figure out all the different log formats and the exact fields you need to find.
A product I've not seen, think about like password managers. You have to wonder, like, is someone going to come up with something where, let's say, GitHub API credentials and my SQL CI credentials or anything like development's using, and you have to proxy through like this service to get there, right? To get to GitHub or whatever. I mean, you could even have the service like rotate the keys or whatever. So basically, the only thing they can talk to those services are, you know, your security tool, right? And then you would know for sure, like, who's talking to it from where, and you can even add controls, like, this can only come from this IP range or this gateway.
They've already kind of started that with mutual authentication. Certain different apps have been deploying that mAuth. That's been causing headaches for all kinds of people trying to deploy stuff. But I think that's the problem that's supposed to be trying to get after, is how do I know that you're you as well as I'm me?
Can you talk a little bit about your move from the Navy to the private sector?
I'd say by far my favorite thing has been no one kicks me out of the room because I don't have the right rank.
That's funny.
Yeah, that was a thing I ran into a lot. I was like, here's the problem on paper and here's the solution. I think this is a good idea. But then you had to sell that idea to your boss, who sold it to their boss, who sold it all the way up the chain until everyone got, you know, credit for it. And someone made, you know, one redaction somewhere and then they get a medal for it. At least they got the work done, right? But in the private sector, it's been more, hey, we'll get some senior engineers in the room. We're going to evaluate your idea. And then if it's good, yeah, we'll work together and we'll roll it out. And so there's just been very little resistance to getting good stuff done. I've loved it. I think my growth has skyrocketed exponentially.
Growth in terms of what?
In terms of technical skill and confidence. Usually what I would do in the Navy, because I would get really, really bored, because they usually give you something that's fairly simple, small packages, right? And then if you do good with that, they give you more and more. I always wanted to do things that were more technical, a little bit deeper. So I would find ways, like, for instance, I don't know how else to say this, but I was kind of a legal assistance person for the punitive processes. Let's say that you got in trouble. I would be the person who wrote up all the paperwork on you and then took you through what's called the non-judicial punishment process. That's where you get to talk to the old man, as they say. He yells at you a whole bunch, takes your rank away, and then sends you away with half pay for 2 months and puts you on restriction and all these things. Anyway, I found out, I was like, how can I make this more interesting? I took an Excel file and I coded it out in VBA. I took a Microsoft Word template and I created those CC fields, like content fields. It would automatically create this like 45-page document based on your, with all the formatting and all the like Microsoft Word stuff done for you. And it would just take the words from all the data that you put in Excel. It would populate that Word document for you. And then it can print it in PDF also. Or when I had to manage ASIs and things, I did something similar with Access, but it would fire off emails to all the different people that were affected for authorized service outages for different regions. Just kind of, I guess, but in doing those things and always working on those things, even though they didn't move the needle forward on some of the core military objectives, when it came time for me to get out, those automation skills and things really paid dividends because they were in high demand.
Were there any mentors you had along the way?
Very much so. Chief Bearham, very, very, very close. He was very, very senior cyber operator. He taught me a lot. More than anything, he taught me how to learn, how to stay humble, and how to lead people without being a dick.
How do you lead people without being a dick?
Stay positive. It really is that simple. Even when it seems like, man, is this person really that dumb? You got to remember, you were definitely that dumb when you were just getting exposed to these things, right? And even a lot of times, senior engineers, they've went their whole career somewhat in a kind of a tight funnel. Like, for instance, I taught someone today how to use a makefile, right? And they blew their mind. They're like, deployment targets, what? You know, that's so cool. And I'm like, yeah, it's fun. These are great. They've been using them since like the 70s. You're only exposed to what you're exposed to. But staying positive, celebrating the wins, even when things seem really, really silly, acknowledging that it's a learning event, 100% of the time, always build a stronger team from those events.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your experience once you left the service?
Cybersecurity has been very challenging to keep up with. Especially when you look on LinkedIn and things like that, and you see that, hey, this guy is 18 and he's already got his CISSP and doing, you know, just running wild on all these things, or top 1% try hack me and everything else. You're like, man, if I even logged into that. But you also got to remember, what are you doing all the time? And there's so many new opportunities popping up that you can get lost in churning on old technologies, right? Like if you're still trying to learn Python right now, that's kind of rough. Like you might want to probably start looking at some of the newer languages like Go and Rust. You know, if you're just now playing around on ChatGPT and figuring out how to recommendations for how to deploy a Lambda and stuff, and, you know, how does that look in Terraform and things like that, you might want to take it to the next step. Go on Coursera, get some of those machine learning operations specialization courses knocked out and figure out how to roll your own, you know, using like Hugging Face transformers at least or something. It's kind of like the GitHub for data science folks. They actually have fully trained models on there and things, and you can just literally in like 3 lines of code, set up your own little mini ChatGPT kind of things, but you can pick your model with whatever it's been trained on and get a lot more specialized.
Have you messed around with that?
I have some projects planned. Yeah, nothing too crazy yet. I'm still very new. I'm like 4 weeks into it. Ask me in about a month. Maybe I'll have something cooler.
What's your take on GPTs using that, you know, to help you code? Or there's even stuff in the news where criminals are using things to clone someone's voice, right? And then blackmail them, right? On certain platforms. I think it was, you know, the FBI already put out a warning that's like, don't send dick pics of yourself to a girl online because it's not a girl. Nobody actually wants to see that. But now I guess they're blackmailing them where they'll just put your face on something like some pornographic material and then try to blackmail you. So for bad or good, I guess it could be used for lots of things.
I think that probably the best defense for AI would probably be in helping detect things that are AI or help detect scammers and things. Because some of those models can actually be fairly small and run locally, or they can be, you can use fairly lightweight REST requests. For instance, GitHub Copilot, right? That actually doesn't run locally on your computer. It actually uses a little tiny REST client and it fires off every snippet of code that you write, just all broken up and tokenized out to this landing server that Microsoft owns. And then they forward that off to Codex. And then behind that, OpenAI is doing all its magic to come up with a recommendation that feeds that back to you. But it all happens so fast that, because you type so slow comparatively to how fast a computer can run those REST calls, that it actually looks fairly seamless to you. But if you compare that to something like Tab 9, where the whole model runs locally on your computer, it's lightning fast. And it's not that the recommendations are any better or worse. It's just kind of different ways to think about it. I guess the way I see it, you could have one that's remotely hosted for figuring out if someone in a chat room is a predator or a fraudster. And that could actually anonymously as a service be like a buddy, an online buddy. And it could see, hey, I think this guy's trying to scam you. Or, hey, this is a known fraudster pattern of talking, right? And I think AI, the best defense for AI ends up being AI, because eventually it's going to get so good as these things get more and more trained and well-trained, it's going to be really difficult for people, if not impossible, to figure out.
That's really interesting. You could have, maybe they could bring back Clippy, the little annoying paperclip. Be your little buddy online, like, hey, this looks like, you know, fraud.
It is. I mean, I think that's probably the best solution for that. And it would be very, it'd be arbitrary to write something to send those requests off and get them evaluated and get it back in near real time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, even like just text messages and stuff you get, right? It's like, well, how much of our data do we want to send off and get analyzed, right? Because, you know, was it Samsung? They had the whole like ChatGPT leak, like how much of like your personal data and how much your company data do you want going to these servers, right? Because once they get popped, then everything's kind of just out there, right?
That's a challenge when it comes to data breaches and things. And I think that's where a lot of those other tools start to come into play. A lot of the attack surface management vendors have dark web scanning tools, and they're always crawling or lurking in forums and things, not trying to, and some of them are even actually spending money to get these data sets from these breaches and aggregate it all. And I think there's a room for a privatized service for that. Like, I think they should be able to provide that to every person and not just, you know, big corporations that can afford it.
Yeah, I think some like credit monitoring services have like certain things like, oh, you appeared in the dark web, but yeah, you have to wonder, should I put some like canary tokens and some documents in my desktop?
I mean, it's a different experience though, right? Because you have like Life Alert and they're like, yeah, we do dark web monitoring, but it's kind of a black box, right? Like, I don't know what they're actually doing and stuff. I don't know what forums are going to and things like that. Whereas a lot of these ASPM vendors, that's their bread and butter. They live and breathe that every day. And it's a very transparent process. They're like, yeah, here's the sites we're going to, right? Like, here's the things we're doing. And granted, they won't give you all their secret sauce. You can ascertain enough of it that it's reproducible steps. I think something more like that, where they're like, hey, man, this is the breach. You were on it. Kind of a screenshot sort of thing. Go ahead, reset these passwords and get all of those linear steps and things, as opposed to, hey, would you like to freeze your credit? Not really.
I want to switch gears a little bit. I have a news story. I'm not going to reveal the whole thing, so I'm going to tell you part of it. I want you to try to guess what happens in it. It's about physical security. So an IT worker in Tokyo stole over $9,000 in trading cards from a shop and about $2,300 in cash. The question is, how do you think he got into the building to steal the cards? Is it A, did he pick the locks? B, hide in the store bathroom and emerged after it closed? Or C, rappel down 6 stories and smash the window?
I think it's got to be the bathroom. Words can spend a long time in the bathroom.
Yeah, maybe hide in the trash can. It was actually C. He rappelled down 6 stories without a harness and smashed the window to get in there and steal the cards.
Mission impossible.
I guess the police caught him on a camera or something, but he was very comfortable. I guess he was in his school's rock climbing club, said in the interview afterwards. Speaking of things in the news, are you familiar with the MoveIt breach?
I was actually on vacation when that happened. This is my first day back.
MoveIt is a managed file transfer service. I believe it might have been called Ipswitch before they were MoveIt. A lot of companies used MoveIt to transfer files, right? Let's say they had outsourced their payroll or their HR department, right? It could be that their payroll company had been using MoveIt, and therefore all of their employees' personal info is now out there in the public, right? Because of the third party they use MoveIt. So MoveIt got breached by a well-known Russian hacking group called Clap. They're a ransomware team. It's a real nightmare. So it's you know, kind of a supply chain attack. But I mean, you can even think back to like the SolarWinds. I think that was like what? It was like a password or something on FTP server. But this is actually a software vulnerability. They were able to use that, get into the MOVEit infrastructure. But like when you're using these third-party SaaS services, right, that you're giving it so much sensitive data, and like their job is to protect your data. It's really tricky.
It is tricky, especially when like a lot of the kind of the gray hats, I've noticed a lot of them pocket zeros and they're like, oh yeah, you know, I've got one for PF since I just keep it in my back pocket in case of the apocalypse, you know, or whatever. They've been, you know, some people, they've been fuzzing around and just messing with some specific piece of software sometimes for like months, and they get it and they're like, well, do I report it? Do I keep it in my pocket? Right. The longer you keep it in your pocket, there's a million other people around the world. A lot of them now are just automated, doing all these tests and things overnight and whatnot. And they send them off for bug bounties most of the time. So your zero is, it's kind of, it's not that it's losing value every day. One, it's dangerous because you could have already patched that hole, right? I don't like that from that perspective, right? It's kind of like looking at a hole in a ship and being like, hey, you know what? I might need that someday. At the same time, are you really ever going to need to attack like some crazy government from a cyber perspective? They're probably going to catch you pretty quick. The odds are against you, right? That being said, not to say you can't pull it off, but it's the odds are against you. But yeah, pocketing those zeros, I think, starts to cause a lot of these problems. It's that, hey, I feel like I'm an accomplished hacker because I hacked this really big name piece of software, especially when it's security software. And you feel good about yourself. You do get that confidence boost, right? And I get that and I appreciate that. However, if you're a security person, you need to be doing security, and the right thing to do is disclosing it. And a lot of these things have been found by other researchers, but they just don't get disclosed, either because they hold it or because the company won't pay out the bug bounty. That's kind of why I do like certain services like HackerOne, where they kind of work as a broker. And then you know you're not wasting your time there. You're already working with people who are going to at least pay out in some kind of way. So your efforts are more likely to be rewarded. At the same time, yeah, you probably don't get that awesome piece of confidence from like, hey man, you know, I cracked like PF cents or something. At the same time, money in your pocket, right? And you get the fact that you actually did something good and that you actually patched a piece of software and started to actually keep people safe. So that's my perspective on it. I'm a little biased, if you can't tell, the reporting side of that.
I'm all for responsible disclosure, whether or not you get a bounty. It's always good to responsibly disclose if you can, for sure.
Now, granted, I don't know much about the MOVEit one, but I'm willing to bet if it was a popular file transfer service, there's probably at least three people holding that same zero realm.
So can you tell me about any books you read lately?
Books? I'm a failed vegan. I keep trying about once a month or so. I keep doing my best.
What's making you fail?
Planning. I don't meal prep well. I'm terrible at it. Yeah, most of the time I'm like, I need something quick, fast, and in a hurry. What's it going to be? And it's usually not a lot of great options that are quick, fast, and in a hurry.
Is this being vegan for strictly dietary stuff? Or is it like you read I think Jonathan Sandifer wrote an eating animals book, and it just tells you about like the nightmares of the slaughterhouses and stuff like that. And you're like, I want to be a vegan now. That happened to me. I think at one point the book's a real nightmare look at the meat industry. It didn't last long, me not eating meat.
For me, it was more for health. I became lactose intolerant. I also have fatty liver altogether and a few other things going on. But it's very hard on my body when I don't eat well, right? Especially if I eat high fat diets, if I eat things with a lot of milk in them, which I grew up on milk. It's delicious. It's my favorite thing. But also sugar, my A1Cs. Through the roof. So I was trying to get a handle on all that and eat a little healthier. And I find that targeting vegan diet tends to get me healthier faster. And I get those check marks from the doctor a little easier. And I also don't have to work out nearly as much to try and compensate for my diets. I tried to do the Daily Dozen from Dr. Greger because I love his podcasts and things. But I ended up being the most successful on the guy who trained Carl Lewis to eat. Dr. John McDougall. That and the McDougall program for maximum weight loss. My two books that were probably the most impactful on getting my health back in check. Eventually, I'll be vegan. I can feel it.
Sweet. What are the two books called?
The Healthiest Diet on the Planet and The McDougall Diet for Maximum Weight Loss. He got Carl Lewis to win a few Olympic gold medals. Vegan, you can definitely still perform on it. I will say when I was following the diet really well, I didn't feel that. There's this weird feeling you get sometimes where you feel kind of weak and almost like you can't move if you're eating wrong. And I never felt that way on the McDougal diet. I always felt actually the most clear I've probably ever felt in my life.
Mine would be the Mode of Mischief podcast. I'm not sure if you've heard of it, but this guy, Keith Corneluck, he's got like this voice, the storytelling voice, that's just great. Now we'll talk about like one of the most famous like Chinese hacking groups and what they've done. And like, I don't know, it makes it kind of exciting, but they tell a lot of stories from various APTs and just notorious things that they've done in kind of an entertaining way. I've been binging that podcast, Mode of Mischief. It's pretty good. It's kind of like a Darknet Diaries type of podcast, but a little more showy, a little more production, I guess, in theater.
A little sugar with the medicine never hurts.
Cool, man. Well, thanks for taking the time to come on the podcast today. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
If you liked the episode today and would like to help support us, please hit subscribe, drop us a review, or share it with your friends. Thanks.